I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program author, activist, and playwright Eve Ensler. Her new memoir is called In the Body of the World, and she will be here in Santa Fe, New Mexico on Friday, April 26th at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, I'm so happy to be talking to you.
I know, I wish you were here in the cafe with us. This is a book that begins with great loss, your own personal loss of not having been held and nurtured and loved when you were small, and on the contrary, having experienced rape and abuse and pain and denial all inside of your family. And it takes us through your discovery and treatment of cancer, and it ends in tremendous love and joy, and specifically the city of joy, and the way in which all of these things are connected, your life and body and the world. Tell us about, first of all, your sense of cancer as a metaphor for some of the horrors of the world that we're living in.
Well, I think, you know, I think when you get cancer, you begin to really look at it both as a literal disease, as a metaphoric disease, and you begin to just really think about what's going on in your body and what has been going on in your body. I mean, the whole idea of psychotically dividing cells that cannot stop. The idea that we have cancer cells in our body, but they only become activated under certain circumstances, you know, where the body is vulnerable or the immune system is weakened or where something in you kind of gives up in some way on the will to live. And I just started to read a lot about cancer and to think about cancer and to think about the cancers everywhere and to think about the kind of cancers that are everywhere, the carelessness that is kind of pervasive throughout the culture, the way we treat the earth, the way we treat each other, the way we don't hold each other in ways that keep each other safe and protect each other. And, you know, I think for me, I began to see, I wanted to figure out why I had cancer, not that it's a thing that anyone can really ever figure out. But, you know, the questions, when it happens in your own body, you begin to ask yourself, well, how did I get it and what did I do to bring it on? Not that anybody does anything to bring it on, but we ask those questions. And I think, you know, I think we all tell ourselves stories about that we're not cancer types. So we have kind of versions of the life we're living. You know, I had a story like I had already had a rough life and I wouldn't get cancer. I was too manic and hyper to get cancer. I was an activist and I exercised a lot and I was a vegetarian and I, you know, and I had a lot of sex and I just had all these reasons why I would never get cancer. And then I had full-blown cancer. And I think then it began, for me, began to be a journey of, okay, if I have these cells that have become activated to bring about my own self-destruction, what do I need to examine in life and where do I need to go inside myself to stop that dividing if it's possible, or to look at why that dividing happened even if I can't stop it? And that's really what compelled me, you know, on my journey with cancer. I think it also led me, while I had cancer, to look at all the similar places of poisoning that were going on. I mean, at one point when I had a very, very bad infection after my surgery, I literally had kind of a sea of poison in my belly, and I had bags that were, like, draining it. And it was the same time as the BP spill in the Gulf Coast. And there was something about it where suddenly I had the Gulf in my body, and my body and the Gulf were one, and pelicans were dying. And there was just this cancer that we brought on through our drilling and through our greed and through our insane, you know, desire for extracting oil in the earth. It just was my body. And there was a period of 2 weeks where I just got lost in the inability to separate what was going on in my body and what was going on in the Gulf.
Was that a good thing for you?
I don't know if it was a good or a bad thing. It was. You know, I think when you're sick, you become very porous, and lines get blurred, and you merge into things. And I think what was good about it was that I no longer had anything separating me from the earth or from the world. And in the long run, it was a very, I think it was a very amazing thing.
You make the connection between the rape of the earth and the rape of women, and especially when you talk about the Congo. And I've sometimes, I mean, this is a connection that's been made by people for a long time, and I've sometimes been leery of that because it draws on kind of like dualistic archetypes of men and women, where you've got woman as earth and man as spirit, you know, mind, body, things like that. But there seems to be something to it also, and especially like when you write about places like the Congo, where rape of the earth, namely large-scale mining for the minerals that we use in our cell phones, is made possible by the brutal rape of women. What does that look like? Explain that connection, how it works.
Well, I think for me, there just seems to be a pervasive rape culture mentality. You know, the indigenous people believe that drilling into the earth is basically drilling into the soul of the mother. And to me, it's very similar to what happens when you're raped. You know, people rape into your soul. I certainly had that experience through being abused as a child. So I think for me, it's taking more than your share. It's going into places where you don't belong. It's going deeper than you've been invited. It's there is a kind of emotion that's very similar, and an intention that's very similar. And I think if you look at the Congo, where I've spent a lot of time in the last 7 years, and you look at the war that's being waged and has been waged on the Congo for the last 14 years, where over, you know, between 6 to 8 million people have died. It's a war on minerals. It's a war where people are basically creating militias and creating armies that go into small villages and towns and invade them, and then go into families and eviscerate families and rape families and rape women, and husbands rape men, and men rape, they get mothers to be raped by their sons, and husbands to rape their daughters, and fathers to rape their daughters. And what they do is they eviscerate the family structure. You know, they destroy the family, they humiliate the family, they force the family to go into exile, and the family flees, and the village flees, and after they've fled, the militias go in and they take over the mines. So that rape has now become a tactic that is systematically used on women, on villages, on communities for the exploitation of minerals. And I think the fact that these two things have come together is not accidental. Do you know, both in the act of exploitation, in the act of domination, in the act of seizing what doesn't belong to you, those minerals don't belong to the outside world. Those minerals belong to the indigenous people. But the world has learned the methods to pillage and seize those minerals for their own interest. And in the same way that women's bodies don't belong to anybody who they haven't given them to. And I think there is a kind of, you know, as we were saying this week in our 1 Billion Rising meeting with the coordinators, you know, patriarchy and capitalism are two sides of the same coin. And, different sides of the same coin. And I think it again is played out in the Congo in the same kind of way.
The kind of cancer you had was weirdly similar to, or in the same places as, the women in the Congo who'd been raped and violated and had these terrible illnesses and fistulas and things that came from their violation. How do you understand that connection?
Well, you know, it's a very mystical thing and a very strange thing. And it was really brought to my attention by my doctors, who oddly had planned to go to Panzi Hospital in Bukavu to operate with Dr. Mukwege on the women before I was diagnosed with cancer. So they were very familiar with the cases that, you know, Dr. Mukwege was dealing with. And one of my surgeons said to my doctor after my surgery, he said, "I really feel like this is a spiritual experience we witnessed today. I mean, so much of what's going on in her body is exactly what the women in Congo are going through and the operations they have after they've been raped." And Dr. Mukwege, when he heard that my tumor had fistulated, he just said he couldn't even speak. He said it's just so odd and so strange, you know, what happened. So I can only say that I think there's a lot we don't know, and I think sometimes I don't think I know that if we really feel each other's pain, we take each other into ourselves. And I have chronically in my life somatized, where I manifest things in my body, that I'm feeling emotionally. So it didn't surprise me.
There's an interesting dialectic, I think, in this book between the sense of cold, hard science on the one hand, which utterly, absolutely saved your life, and on the other hand, this sense of magic and connection and faith and love and making the connections that you were just talking about and the emotional healing, and those things go together in a way that was, I don't know exactly how to put it, but just weirdly inspiring and magical. And I got this sense of faith in a kind of, despite all these horrors that you write about, both in what you experience in your body and in the Congo and in the world, this kind of sense that there is really a coherent bigger picture of some kind, even though we can't fully understand it.
Well, it's funny. I oddly do feel that. And sometimes it slips out of my grasp, that big picture, when things are really particularly horrific. But it was really interesting with the chemo, because I was terrified of chemo. More than I was terrified of the surgery, more than I was terrified of the infection, more than I was terrified of cancer in a way. Like, the idea of just putting poison into my body, I found deeply frightening. And I think I really have come to see that you don't know what part of the whole treatment experience is what saves you. And maybe it's all what saves you, and maybe it's the commitment to the treatment that saves you, and maybe it doesn't save you, and maybe you just get spared for a moment. Who knows? But I do know that the chemo for me became a very shamanic experience and a very profound experience. And because I had people who guided me through it and helped me with it, and because I also really began to see that thing of turning poison to medicine, just really living that as a principle. And, I think we want the world to be either East or West. And I think there's a reason why there's East and West. There's kind of a coming together of both those things, and we need both. And I'm here to say, I bless medicine. I bless it. I bless my surgeons, and I bless my doctors, and I bless chemotherapy. It kept me, and it's keeping me alive. And I also bless all the incredibly spiritual and invisible and other ingredients of love and tenderness and kindness and vision that were really surrounding me throughout my treatment. And I don't think I would say one was more important than the other.
Well, there was this profound thing that I guess a psychotherapist or a healer of some kind said to you, namely, the chemotherapy is not for you. What was it for?
Well, that was the most genius thing, and Sue, who's this amazing person who's been on my journey with me a long time, she just came and she said to me, the chemo's not for you, it's for your cancer. It's for all the perpetrators in your life. It's for all the stories that live inside you of women being raped. It's for the part of you that's believed that you were bad your whole life. You have an opportunity now to burn that away. And I want you to visualize that every time that chemo goes into you, you're killing off the perpetrators, and you're killing off the badness, and you're killing off the pain, and you're killing off. And it was the most genius thing anyone has ever given me as, advice, because, or just as a vision to hold on to, or a way to contain and hold the experience. Because when I would sit there for my 5 hours, getting my treatment into my port, I would just imagine, it burning away that which needed to go. And she said to me, and when you get very sick, imagine how hard these agents are working to clean out what needs to go. And I have to tell you, for me, it worked. Yeah. It truly worked. By the end of chemo, I felt like this darkness that I had carried around most of my life had lifted.
It's very interesting. I mean, when I read that, and I tend to have a bit of an allergy to too much magical thinking when it comes to disease, but I read that and I thought, oh my God, this is it. She's right. It went inside of my body. I mean, that whole little chapter about the chemotherapy doing this archetypal magical stuff. I wanted to get back to something that was earlier in the book, namely the whole question of what you call somnolence, the sense of going through life in a haze, not heeding warning signs. You didn't heed your own warning signs, even though you saw them clearly, and the connection between that and things like climate change and what it takes to break out of that in yourself and what it takes to break out of that collectively.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for asking that question, because I think, you know, I think we all are in a state of somnolence. You know, the planet is in a state of somnolence, and it's that, it's like neither living in either world, but where you're in denial and you're half asleep. And I know for me, I have now been able to kind of retrace the moments of my life where I went back and I entered that state of somnolence in order to protect myself from pain and protect myself from the harsh realities of what were going on around me. But I think the irony, of course, is that in protecting ourselves from the harsh realities, we actually bring on the harsh realities because we don't do anything to stop them. And I think part of what I've really come to see through this experience of cancer, and through many things, I think, leading up to it, is that I want to live in the truth now. You know, I don't see my somnolence as a protection anymore. I realize that by not going to the doctor early on in my process, when I knew something was wrong with me, I didn't protect myself. In fact, it allowed the tumor to grow bigger and bigger. And I think we all know, like, something is deeply wrong right now with the planet, with the level of violence that's happening, with the bizarre incidents of violence, with the insane poverty. I mean, 1 out of 4 people in America are living below the poverty level. I mean, we're talking about massive poverty across the earth. We're talking about people who have billions and billions of dollars where other people can't get 1 banana for a family of 4. You know, we're talking about such incredible disparities, and we all know it's wrong. We all know something is so off, but we continue on in our lives, you know, in this half asleep state. And I think the only way one can wake up is by desiring to wake up, you know? And I don't know fully how we impart the desire to wake up, but I will say, being awake feels really good. And even if it means facing some days when the sorrow of the world enters you or you have the despair of the world, it is so much better than that half awake, numbish, depressive, nowhere state, you know, that we live in when we're somnolent.
One of the things that really gets me about the brutality in the Congo that you write about, and you tell some stories that would keep even the most jaded person in the world awake at night, but it's not even that. It's the fact that when you go to Congress, you go to the UN, you go to prime ministers, people who have actual, real, genuine power to do something about it, you're met with their somnolence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think part of the, you know, it's like if you see someone sleeping, right, and you feel like they're in danger, do you shake them awake? Because that will scare them more. Do you kindly wake them up? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, how do we awaken people without frightening into a deeper state of somnolence? How do we invite people to engage in the world without fear? I mean, these are the big questions right now. I think part of it is helping people understand that their sleep state is not protecting them. That, in fact, if you as a person of power in the world allow a place like the Congo to continue, not only is it a profound inhumanity, but you are allowing that state of existence to spread in the collective consciousness, which means it's actually proliferating in many places. And that means it eventually can come to where you are. So by denying, for example, what's going on in Fukushima and pretending that that nuclear power plant isn't connected to your nuclear power plant in your own backyard, right, you're not protecting yourself. You're just pushing that out of your consciousness so that when it happens in your own backyard, you'll suddenly be surprised. But you won't have saved yourself, and you won't have saved your community. And I think part of it is, how do we help people wake up, you know, without the worst catastrophic thing happening to them, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is a great and central question, and I think that this continual in your memoir going back and forth between the political world situation, the situation of the oceans and so on, and your own body, I mean, it's a good place to start. Like the question, how do you wake somebody up without scaring them? In my own life, I think the most gentle waking up I've ever had was staying at somebody's house and having a cat put its paw gently on my shoulder.
Right.
And I thought, I'd like to wake up that like that every day.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. But do we do that? How do we do that with climate
right.
change? How do we do that with violence? How do we do that with poverty, you know?
Yeah. I mean, these are questions that I can't answer, you can't answer. We all have to kind of come together and think about them and take it as, I mean, a Zen koan that we think about every day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
We're talking to Eve Ensler about her new book, In the Body of the World. I think one of the ironies, or maybe just sort of two sides of the coin that one can't help but see looking at your life's work, is that even early on in the Vagina Monologues, your pain and your disconnection from your own body opened up the possibility of healing for so many other people. It seems like your own abuse and disconnection gave you a huge capacity to bear other people's pain and hear stories of pain. How do you see that? How do you experience it?
Well, look, I feel very, very fortunate in that writing has always served as a way of transforming the pain I've been in into something hopefully useful, you know? And that has been the great gift of my life. You know, if you were to say, what's the gift? That's the gift, you know? I think that's the function of art, isn't it? You know, to use what's inside of us to hopefully articulate truth that free other people and get other people to examine what's going on in themselves and to know they're not alone in what they're struggling with. And, you know, I think for me, I've been on this amazing kind of, this cross-continent journey, cross-galaxy journey, cross-metaphysical journey back into my body, you know, as long as I've been on Earth, to try to find a way to get back in here after having left at a very young age due to sexual and physical violence. And I think to some degree, we're all on this migration back into our bodies. You know, the whole planet is trying to get back home and back into ourselves. And when you're not connected to your body, you're sadly not connected to the Earth. It's very hard to be connected. Because it's the point of location, it's the loci of where we come from. And I think one of the reasons it's so easy for us to hurt the Earth and to damage the Earth and to rape the Earth and to abuse the Earth is that we don't feel her pain, because we don't feel our own pain, you know?
Tell us about the relationship you developed with the tree outside your hospital room window.
Yeah, that was quite beautiful. I think... I make a joke in the book, like I went to school, college in Vermont, and I was so disconnected then and so disconnected from myself. And when I left Vermont, I was like, I hope I never see another effing tree. Everything about trees terrified me. It was so deeply intimate. And so I felt like an exile from it. And then I got very, very sick during part of my cancer, and I was put into this room that had a window, and I could not move for weeks in this room because I was so sick, and the only thing in my view was this tree. And at first I was very annoyed by the tree, and then as the days went on, I fell in love with this tree. And the tree entered me, and I began this deep relationship with tree. And it became my point of meditation, and I just studied bark some days, and I studied, the limbs some days, and I just loved everything about this tree, the way it moved in the wind and the way when it rained. And by the end of my time in that room, I had fallen in love with tree. And really, it felt like the beginning of my return to the earth and my return to a connection with the earth. And then I got put back in that room again. And one of the great things that I learned over the course of my treatments is that Taxol, which was one of the ingredients in my chemotherapy, is actually from the yew tree, and they don't even have to destroy the tree to get it because they can take it from the needles. And so actually a tree was saving me through my whole process as well. So it was this wonderful kind of coming together.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. There were some other changes that I thought were interesting. One of them was going from lifelong or almost lifelong vegetarianism to meat eating, going from being clean and sober to smoking pot to get through the chemotherapy and all of that. And I think it's important to just talk about embracing those kinds of changes, which in some people's minds might be kind of going backwards.
Well, you know, everything I say about cancer surprised me. You know what I mean? I hadn't eaten meat in 30 years, and I came out of the chemo. I came out of the operation after 9 hours, and all I wanted was a hamburger. Now, I don't know that that's lasted, do you know what I mean? But there was a period of time where I just needed to eat meat, and I eat chicken now, and I know that I need it. I can only explain that that's what my body is hungering for, and I need to do that to stay alive. And you know, I have to listen to what's going on inside me. And, you know, and I've been sober a very, very long time, maybe 36 years. But there was a moment where I knew that smoking pot and would get me through the chemo. And it was as if all these rules I had made up about my life had been defied by the cancer. It was like, well, you were a vegetarian for 30 years and you got cancer, and you were sober for 30 years and you got 34 years and you got cancer. And it was like, maybe right now is a moment where you just need to not know who you are and not have boundaries and not have walls and not have definitions around you and just go with what is revealing itself. And I'm really glad I did that, because so much of the story I was telling about my life had been an absolutely important story to protect me and get me to where I was. But I also had to loosen it up in order to get to the next place. And it was really very profound, you know.
Well, that whole question of, and I think it applies to everybody, whether we're sick or not, is what is your narrative? How is that narrative serving you? Is it true? What can change? And there were quite a lot of things that changed in your own life narrative.
So many things changed, and so many ideas I had about myself, you know? And I think one basic idea that I had about myself, which I talk about in the scan of the meditation of love, was that, you know, I knew as a young person that the whole idea of marriage, perfect romantic love, finding the person, just didn't work for me conceptually. Like, I knew that. I just never was drawn to it. I never dreamed as a young woman that I'd grow up and get married and have children. It was just never my dream. But somehow, as the years progressed, I moved into that. I got married, and then I was in a long-term relationship, and I was really trying to make that work as if it were some construct that proved I somehow had legitimized myself as a person, you know? And what happened with cancer was, I was really alone in the sense that I wasn't with a partner or wasn't with a beloved, but I was surrounded by this incredible community of love. And it just hit me one day. I have been loving my whole life. I have been loved, and I have loved my whole life. And it has not been in the ways that I was told I was going to love. But it isn't of less value, and it hasn't filled me any less deeply. And it was such a profound revelation that I really felt released from that over-narrative, you know, that uber-narrative that I felt encased in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it made me think about something that I've been thinking about for a long time. The question of what you mean when you say we, like we for a lot of people means their family, and for some people we means their community, and for some people it means every person on earth, and for some people it means every biological organism on earth. And to really think about that, and I was thinking about that during your revelation that all the friendship and love surrounding you was what probably everybody else would call true love, with a capital T.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's exactly it. And I think for the first time in my life, I'm really looking at what kind of love, like in terms of a relationship, would work for me, and also just being so happy about the life I have, like feeling so grateful for the women friends I have and for the male friends I have and for all the team that I work with in V-Day and just my sisters around the globe who I'm in struggle with on a daily basis in terms of bringing about an end to violence and the liberation of women. I mean, those are my loves. Those are my loves, Monique in the Philippines and Abha in India. And, you know, I can just go down the list, Agnes in Kenya and Christine in Congo. I mean, I'm in love with those women,
right.
You know?
Well, and you talk to them every day, even when you were in the worst throes of your cancer and cancer treatment. And, I mean, people had to come up to you and say, Eve, why don't you put down that book on genocide? I mean, you never left your work really at all, it seems like.
No, exactly. it's funny. I think I saw this lovely man at this event last night who was on a walker, and he was about 80, and he was in just fantastic shape, and he had been with his wife for 60 years, and they were just like the happiest people, and I said, what's the secret? And he said, work. That's the secret. Never stop working. And I think for me, I don't know if I would have survived cancer if I hadn't felt the City of Joy there and the women of Congo depending on me. I needed them to be depending on me to live. And I think sometimes it's kind of like the somnolence thing. I think we think that responsibility is a pressure when really it's an inspiration. And I think at this point activism and the work in the world is my life. I don't think it's separate from my sickness or separate from my wellness, you know?
Tell us about the City of Joy.
Well, the City of Joy is, I have to say, the most magnificent place I've ever been to on the planet. And it really, you know, for 7 years, V-Day's been working in the Congo. And at the request of Dr. Denis Mukwege, who's a Congolese doctor in Bukavu. And I went there originally to see how we could help him at his invitation and spent weeks and weeks interviewing women and writing a piece. And then we began to really start talking with and being with the women there and finding out what they wanted. And, you know, we initially started with the V-Day campaign to break the silence and to shatter taboos and to educate women across the country on sexual violence. And then the women said what they really wanted was a place where they could go, a place where they could heal, a place which was theirs, a place where they could be trained, a place where they would be lifted out of their misery, and where they could become leaders. And so we built that place, and we opened it a year and a half ago, and we were just about to have our third graduating class. And it is the most magnificent place. It's in eastern Congo. It's in the middle of a war zone. It's in the middle of enormous poverty and a world that's very chaotic and fractured. When you come into City of Joy, it is the lotus rising in the mud, and it is the future of Congo. And it is owned by the Congolese. It is directed by the Congolese. It was built by the Congolese. It's theirs. And V-Day's job outside of Congo is to find the resources so we can be at their back. And it's a place where every 6 months, 90 women come. They are healed through this amazing therapy, which is group therapy, theater therapy, dance therapy, trauma therapy. It's brilliant, the treatment. And then they're educated in literacy, in languages, there's a Google Center where they learn computers, where they learn agriculture, where they learn rights and civic, you know, their civic obligations, where they learn skills, where they learn sexual education. And the only commitment they have to make is that whatever they learn, whoever they become, they must bring that back to their communities and share it and become leaders in their own communities. And we're about to graduate our third class, and I have to say the results are just mind-blowing. And the girls have gone back, and they've started collectives. They've opened restaurants. They've stood up to governments. They've influenced their families. They've become leaders in their small communities. They've started networks. And we're seeing this really women spreading this all over the Congo because it's a national program. And I have to say, when you come to City of Joy, it is so gorgeous. I mean, there are, you know, animals and there are flowers, roses taller than me, and they're singing and dancing. It's just the air there, the quality of love and care and healing is so profound. And we just bought an amazing farm called the V-World Farm, which is 20 minutes up the road, and it's huge. It's the size of Central Park, and it will become a collective for the women. We're going to open an agricultural school there and a school for children. It grows. It has tilapia ponds and pigs, and it has the capacity to grow tons of crops, rice, and every vegetable in the world. And we think it will become a very sustaining and you know, beautiful, beautiful project for not only women around Congo, but obviously for women in that community.
Do you see this work having changed to a significant extent any of the consciousness about genital mutilation?
Oh, well, you mean in other countries? Genital mutilation isn't in the Congo. It's not one of the problems there. But in terms of Kenya and other places where in the Gambia where we're supporting women who are doing this work, they're having enormous impact. And I would say that Agnes, in the 10 years we've been supporting her in Kenya, has probably stopped FGM in 3/4 of the Maasai community. And in the Gambia, where Issa Touré is doing her work, she in 7 provinces, she's ended FGM in 4 of the provinces. So I think people are having enormous impact on FGM all over the world.
So City of Joy is open. You are now, knock on wood, cancer-free and have
cancer-free
been cancer-free.
3 years this month, so I'm feeling quite happy. But, you know, it's a day at a time. We have no idea. We have no idea. Somebody asked me if I was in remission, and I said, well, only if you are. Because I think we're all in remission, right? I mean, cancer cells live in our body, and they're there. And there are certain conditions in certain situations which they're activated. And that's why we have to live in a life where we are not only present in this moment so that every moment matters, but also where we look at where are we unconsciously or consciously stepping out of ourselves and not paying attention, you know?
Yeah. The last chapter of your book is called Second Wind, and it's a kind of, I don't know, it's a kind of like call to action. And again, along the same lines of how do you wake people up? How do you wake yourself up? And how do you let go of fear? And I think, in a way, that is the process that all of us need to go through. Because when I was reading that chapter, I was thinking, what are the fears that I haven't even named that are living inside of me? And I think that's kind of all of our task, to look at that.
I totally think that's true. And I think for me, you know, I really got into this whole notion of a second wind because I feel like I'm in my second wind now, you know? I don't know, like, I am fully aware that if I had this cancer like 10 or 20 years ago, I would be dead now. You know, there weren't the cures and there weren't the possibilities of treatments that I've had right now. And so now I've been given this second wind. I've been given this second life. And it's really up to me now to make the most of every single moment. And I think when you kind of live, I don't know, I hear this experience a lot with other people who've had this experience, that once you've kind of passed through this, you kind of I don't have the fear I used to have. I feel like every moment matters and we've got to go now and we've got to rise up and we've got to make transformation and we've got to be daring and we've got to be disruptive and we've got to be bold and unafraid. And I don't think I could have ever kind of imagined 1 Billion Rising or put out that call or just believed it was possible or just fought to make it possible had I not had cancer. I really don't. I think it came out of that experience because it was just like, well, what do we have to lose? Let's just go for it. Let's see what happens, and let's put our heart and souls into it and see if we can build a world community and rise on different. And it happened, you know? And I think that kind of intensity of intention and devotion and just saying, I believe it's possible, in every aspect of our lives makes things happen. you know?
Eve, do you feel like having written this book, and this is a cancer memoir, and there are a lot of cancer memoirs that are very different from this one, is this connecting you with different people, with different communities than you've come in contact with before?
I think it's a very good question. I don't see this as an only cancer memoir per se, but I do see cancer as the kind of engine that raced through my life, which brought about a lot of transformation and investigation. And I think what I'm very happy about is that even in just, I looked on Amazon and it's linking me to oncology, it's linking me to medicine, it's linking me to abuse, it's linking me to women, so I'm very excited about broadening the community that I get to be in touch with. And I have to say I'm particularly glad to be communicating with people who have survived cancer or who are experiencing cancer, because I think so many of us get it, and unfortunately, so many of us will get it based on the environment and everything that's going on. And I think we need to really think about how do we look at cancer as a way of transformation as opposed to just doom, because it's here, and it will inspire us to clean up the environment and to create a world which is going to stop creating cancers, both in the world, and you know, inside us, but also in the way we treat the world.
Eve Ensler is an author, activist, and playwright. Her new memoir is called In the Body of the World. She will be here in Santa Fe on Friday, the 26th of April, at the Lenzic, and this is the first stop on your book tour, is that right?
It is, and I'm so happy it's Santa Fe, because I love Santa Fe, and I just want to say to all the amazing people in Santa Fe who rose on 1 Billion Rising, bravo, brava. I was so blown away by the scale of the rising there, and just to thank all the activists and Cecile Lipworth, who was so instrumental in making that happen, but just to see everybody coming together there, and I just can't wait to see everyone and kind of like, you know, just dwell in the aftermath of that huge success and maybe even get to announce the big plans for next year.
Can you give us a hint?
I can't yet, but I think I will be by the. I'm thinking that I'm going to announce it in Santa Fe.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait to hear what that is. Where were you on the day of 1 billion?
I was in the Congo.
You were in the Congo.
Dancing with 10,000 people in Bukavu.
Nice. And do you have a sense of what the kind of ripple effect has been of that day?
We're beginning to get a sense, and we just spent the weekend looking at just the beginning footage. You know, there were 207 countries, so we only got to L. I mean, it's just staggering how many risings there were. I really believe we had 1 billion people. I mean, when you start to see all the footage and the size and the scale of people's risings, it's stunning. I think there are so many amazing outcomes, and I mean, I can just name a few off the bat. One is that we made violence against women a global issue. And people came to understand it's not a national or tribal or ethnic phenomenon. It's actually patriarchy. It's everywhere. We created massive global solidarity, which has fueled so many local initiatives because they don't feel alone anymore and they don't feel the humiliation and shame that they felt before. I think it's brought enormous amount of money into the movement in various places. We had groups that have come together that have never come together before. First of all the major groups working against violence against women came together. Then we had trade unionists and domestic workers and rural women and Dalit women and farm workers. And I have to say those women, those grassroots women, were really leading this movement, the rural women, throughout the, you know, whether they were farm workers in America or domestic workers in the Philippines. Those women were at the head of this movement, which is why I think it worked. And then we had a cross-section of huge institutions, whether it was the UN, which stopped its day and did 1 Billion Rising, or the International Criminal Court, which has now joined forces with us, or the European lobby, which did a flash mob in the lobby, or whether it was, you know, presidents and prime ministers and governors and mayors standing up. It was unbelievable. And I think it taught us all, you know, us grassroots activists who've been working, that we have enormous power. And when we come together, we even have more power. And we're seeing legislation passed. We're seeing people like VAWA, you know, happened on the heels of that. And many people who were working on VAWA called us, and we were part of the thank you call to say like that wind of 1 billion rising helped a great deal get VAWA through. And we're seeing the same thing in bills that have happened all over the world. So we're just beginning to look at the massive kind of reverberations of what, and the number of groups it's created, and the number of initiatives it's created, and the number of people who are now working with other people, and particularly looking at the intersections. Because we were able to engage people from different sectors who were working on, for example, climate change, or working on poverty, or working on racism, or working on LGBT and trans issues, we were able to engage those people in what we were dealing with, and then we were able to engage with what they were dealing with, and we began to form amazing coalitions. And the last piece I would say is that we saw a massive engagement of men. And I think that it has been a profound shift and is leading to, at least in B-Day, a real evaluation of what we're going to do in terms of men, you know, joining us in this struggle.
I think that's so important. I was just going to bring that up myself. It's like this next generation of men is so profoundly different from, let's say, their grandfathers, that I think that really needs to be acknowledged and trumpeted.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we have to really support them to get to rise, you know? Yeah.
Well, Eve Ensler, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. And thank you for your wonderful questions, as always.
Thank you so much for being with us. And congratulations on your survival and all the amazing work that you've done. And I know there's still a lot more to come.
Thank you so much.
Eve Ensler is the award-winning playwright of The Vagina Monologues. Her new memoir is called In the Body of the World. She will be in Santa Fe at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center at 7:30 on Friday, April 26th. You can get tickets by calling 988-1234, or you can go to ticketssantafe.org.